Welcome to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Here we go, Soccer Morning Wednesday. Welcome in at worldsoccertalk.com. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Man, we've got a big show lined up for you today. Some of the biggest stories in the world of soccer will be covered right here over the next hour plus. Let's start with our guests. Two very excellent guests return guests to this program. Eric Gomez, who may have the record for appearances. He may have the Soccer Morning Caps record. I'm not sure what that is. We haven't tabulated said number. But it's, I imagine Eric's in the 50 range, right? Eric Gomez covering Mexican soccer. He'll be on the show in a couple of minutes to talk about the preparations for L3 when it comes to USA and Mexico on Saturday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, Rose Bowl, Pasadena, California, Confederations Cup berth on the line, and injuries in the Mexican camp, plus some news as to their potential replacement for permanent head coach. Also on this program, Ross Dunbar covers German soccer. We'll get into Jurgen Klopp's big move to Liverpool with him. Check out whether or not this is going to be a good fit for Liverpool, good fit for Klopp. Lots to talk about there. These are, again, the two of the biggest stories in the world of soccer. But we've got more. There are other things happening. Let's run down the news here on a Wednesday before we dive into those discussions with Eric and Ross. Per reports in the United Kingdom, Bob Bradley is quote-unquote a shock candidate to replace Dick Advocaat at Sunderland. If you've been following the saga of Dick Advocaat leaving, numerous names have been put out there as possible replacements, including Sam Allardyce. Nigel Pearson has reportedly been approached. It's not clear exactly where things stand. Remember, the owner of Sunderland is an American, Ellis Short. The odds on Bob Bradley have moved a lot over the last couple of days, especially with these new reports. He has moved from 10th, 12th favorite up to 3rd favorite behind Allardyce and Pearson. And the Stabæk chief executive, whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce, has said that their club will not stand in Bradley's way should Sunderland come calling. A lot of this is about whether or not Bob Bradley himself has reached out to Sunderland or if Sunderland has shown some interest in Bob Bradley. Unclear where that stands, but bears watching. Would clearly be a momentous thing for an American head coach to get an opportunity in the English Premier League. Speaking of Mexico, they've suffered another injury blow ahead of Saturday's showdown with the USA for the right to go to the Confederations Cup in 2017. Leon midfielder Jose Juan Vasquez has pulled out of that team with a couple of muscle injuries after reporting to camp. Leon teammate Elias Hernandez takes his spot on the roster. We'll get into what this means with Eric Gomez in a couple of minutes. Speaking of Mexico's head coaching position, former New York Red Bulls head coach Juan Carlos Osorio, most recently of Sao Paulo in Brazil, is in line to take over the Mexican national team job. Per reports, Sao Paulo themselves issued a statement that said that's where Osorio was going when he left, when he decided to leave Sao Paulo last week, or early this week, as a matter of fact. Again, Osorio's resume includes successful stints in his native Colombia with Atletico Nacional, as well as in Mexico with Puebla. So he's a known quantity to FMF officials and seems to be in line, him and his notebook, in line for the Mexican national team job. The US U-23s finished out a perfect group stage in Olympic qualifying with a 4-0 rout of Panama last night. Jerome Kiesewetter, Jordan Morris came on as substitutes to help spark the attack. Big second half, all four goals coming in the second half for the Americans. Kiesewetter himself with a goal and an assist in the win. FIFA presidential candidate Chung Myung-jun, who is out front, the guy that likes to talk the most about what's going on with the FIFA presidential race, has called Sepp Blatter, quote, a hypocrite and a liar, and says he is planning to sue the outgoing FIFA president for, wait for it, $100 million, at least $100 million. His plan is to sue Blatter for embezzlement in Swiss court, and he pledges to turn over any damages to FIFA. That's an interesting development. Again, remember, we reported already that Chung Myung-jun says he's in line for a 19-year ban by the FIFA executive committee for things he believes were not illegal when he did them, which was back the South Korea bid in the World Cup and propose a plan to help fund FAs around the world. He also says 4 years of that ban is simply because he criticized the FIFA Ethics Committee. A couple of big games in MLS tonight as the season winds down, the regular season getting down to the nitty-gritty here. The New York Red Bulls hosting the Montreal Impact in a massive game for the Impact, considering their tenuous hold on a playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. Yesterday, had a chance to talk to Paul Tenorio on the Sirius show. He believes that it's very possible for Orlando City to catch Montreal. It's only 1 point gap at the moment. Of course, Montreal has two games in hand, but their schedule down the stretch is very rough for Drogba and company. So they need to get as many points as possible. We'll see if they can do so at Red Bull Arena tonight at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. The other MLS matchup tonight, Vancouver, FC Dallas. FC Dallas in line to grab the first seed in the Western Conference by virtue of their games in hand. They have two on the LA Galaxy who are a point ahead in the West. Vancouver is 2 points back of LA Galaxy and 1 point back of FC Dallas. We'll see what happens this evening. Obviously, FC Dallas a better home team than a road team. Vancouver a better road team than a home team. It kind of turns those things topsy-turvy in the Western Conference, where it'll come down to the last couple of matches to see what the seeding shakes out. You've got the Galaxy and FC Dallas already with their spots booked in the 2015 MLS playoffs. All right, we've set the stage. Very quick rundown of the news. Lots to cover. Mexico, Germany. Let's do that. Let's get our friend Eric Gomez, the all-time Caps leader on Soccer Morning, if I'm not mistaken, on the program in just a minute. It's Soccer Morning. WorldSoccerTalk.com. Don't go anywhere. Be right back.
Facing the crowd, you're talking too loud.
When it comes to the USA against Mexico, this game's different. As Michael Bradley puts it, the passion, the colors, the respect, the hate. Soccer Morning listeners, I'd like to invite you to join me and Jared Dubois this Saturday for the USA versus Mexico broadcast on Rabble.tv at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. With Rabble, the concept is simple. All you have to do is tune into the USA versus Mexico game on TV, press the mute button, and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me and Jared on your desktop, through your iOS Android app, or through your mobile browser. Plus, before or during the game, you can join in by posting your questions or observations in the comments section. Or why don't you create your own broadcast, call one of your team's games. It's easy. Sign up for free today. Try it out. Join me and Jared this Saturday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern for the USA versus Mexico on Rabble.tv, where it's your team and your call.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
All right, we turn now to our good friend Eric Gomez, EricGomez86 on Twitter. Talk a little USA-Mexico ahead of the big game on Saturday night. We'll do it from a Mexican perspective here with Eric. Eric, how are you, sir?
Doing good. Just getting my bearings ready to travel to LA and cover that big game.
I'm extremely jealous. I saw Ivis Gullersep tweeted out yesterday that 700 people have been credentialed for that game with just as many rejections. That's quite the showing for you know, a contrived game. Let's be honest about that.
Absolutely, but I still think that interest in this game will always be high. You know, anytime you get a United States versus Mexico game and there's something on the line, more so than a mere friendly. I mean, I've been to games that are mere friendlies between these two teams that have had a significant media presence. So, I mean, a Confederations Cup berth, call it what you want, give it as much importance as you want. I still think this is going to be a pretty big game for both of those teams.
Now, so much, you know, a lot of the discussion around the USA team right now is not really focused on the players. I mean, we know who Klinsmann's called in. There have been a couple of odd exclusions, but nothing groundbreaking. It's usually just about Klinsmann and his job prospects should he lose this match. Now, there's some defeatism in there, but I think a lot of people think the United States has a decent shot at this, of course, and part of that is because Mexico seems to be, you know, in a bit of turmoil. We've got an interim head coach in Tuca Ferretti, and we'll maybe come to him in the coaching situation in a minute. But we also have a roster that's a bit in flux because of ins and outs with injury. The latest news is Vasquez having to pull out of this. How big of a deal is that?
Well, Vasquez is one of Mexico's best holding midfielders, bar none. So I think that losing him, and given the fact that he would have been considered for that starting 11, I mean, he wasn't a shoo-in by any means, but I still think that he would have been a great addition to that squad, given the fact that the United States loves to counterattack, loves to play Mexico on the break. Vasquez is one of those players that is never going to be surprised by one of those tactics. So losing him is a pretty big deal. If not for the starting lineup against the United States, he was definitely an option to come off the bench should something arise. So, you know, now you're down to only a couple of players who can fill that role. Of course, one of the guys who came in for another injured player, Giovanni Dos Santos, Javier Güemes from America, he can play that role. I wouldn't say that he's as good as Vasquez. Another guy who's definitely as good as Vasquez, but going through a bad spell at the moment, is Hector Herrera, over at Porto, who has pretty much been benched at this point by his club, but is still, I would say, one of the top three, top five players for Mexico talent-wise. So it's not something that's going to kill Mexico by any means, but losing Vasquez at this point in time is a pretty big deal.
You know, again, it's kind of hard to keep track. We had the reports that both Andres Guardado and Rafa Márquez were going to miss out. Now, apparently, both of them are going to be healthy. I mean, imagine that's a race to full fitness for those two players.
Yeah, I mean, Guardado was available for PSV, and he started last weekend. So I think his fitness should not come into question, at least for this game, October 10th. Rafa Márquez is a different story. He's 36 years old. He hasn't trained fully since that injury. I think they're just holding out for him. I think they're going to hold out for him as long as they possibly can. And I think that even if he doesn't play, he's an important veteran presence. I think Duca Ferretti is a guy who values that. And if he's healthy enough to play, he'll play. But I still think that this is more of a decoy. You know, it's just giving Klinsmann a little bit more to think about.
And we have Giovanni Dos Santos, obviously injured on the weekend for the LA Galaxy, and he'll be out. You mentioned his replacement on the roster, but I think what is more of interest to U.S. fans, and obviously something that Tuca Ferretti has to deal with, is just replacing dynamism that Gio brings. And not that Gio was guaranteed to be a starter necessarily, but we know what he can do when he's on the field.
Absolutely, and I still think that losing Giovanni Dos Santos for any game, when you're the Mexican national team, is a big deal. He usually comes to play. He's a player who is able to open up the field, and I think now fans of MLS have been able to watch that firsthand. When he's at his best, he's damn good, but he is a pretty inconsistent player, and that is no knock on him. I think that's just taking a look back at his career, not just for Mexico, but at the club level as well. But he's shown up for Mexico in big games, and the United States men's national team fans certainly know about that. I mean, that 2011 goal has been played about 11 million times this week, both on Mexican and American TV and on the internet. You still have a pretty good offensive roster left. You still have pretty good players to choose from. You've got Carlos Vela, you've got Raul Jimenez, you've got Chicharito, of course, and then you've got Tecatito Corona, who has just been absolutely on fire for Porto, both in the league and in the Champions League. So they lose a lot with Giovanni being injured, but they still have a pretty good group of players to choose from.
Yeah, I think Tecatito is the guy that makes everybody in American colors quake in their boots a little bit. He's the incredibly talented player. We've seen what he can do, and imagine that Klinsmann will have to account for him somehow. Losing Dos Santos a blow, but certainly not the kind of thing that would prevent Mexico from winning this game. So again, sort of in the preparation here with the ins and outs, with Vasquez having to leave, with the replacements coming in, Elias Hernandez, I know, has been added. Where do things? I mean, how do you feel, and how do you think Ferretti feels about the team at this point in terms of just getting ready for that match?
Yeah, I think even considering the injuries, Ferretti knows that he has the best available team. He has two of Mexico's best players who have assumed leadership roles for the past decade or so, Rafael Marquez and Andrés Guardado. Guardado is a shoe-in to play, and he'll definitely start. Marquez, of course, we went over it. Offensively, there's a lot of firepower there, even with Giovanni Dos Santos out. And even in the midfield, you lose a guy like Ayito Vasquez, but you still have Hector Herrera, who can definitely give you a great game, given his talent level. So I don't think that he's Duca Ferretti is stressing this too much. I think that he knows that he has the best team available to him. And I think the one thing that I would kind of point out is not necessarily odd, but definitely worth looking at a second or two, is Mexico will have one day to train and to be in Los Angeles before the game, which is October 9th. They've been training this week in Mexico City. You know, obviously there are certain advantages to that with the altitude. You're better going from a high altitude to sea level at any point in time if you're a soccer player. But it still frightens me a little bit that Mexico will only have 24 hours to kind of look at the pitch, look at their surroundings, and get ready for that game. They have a great medical staff, but there's always a risk when you fly into an important game like this with just, you know, 36 hours before kickoff. Yeah. So that's something that I would look at. But in terms of the training, in terms of the tactical arrangement, it's going to be a 4-4-2. Duca Ferretti's not going to surprise anybody there. I think what we can look at in terms of a tactical surprise or maybe players being deployed in different roles a la Jurgen Klinsmann would be with Hector Herrera, with Andrés Guardado, and maybe even Tecatito Corona. Tecatito Corona has been used mainly as a winger, but during his spell at Porto, during his spell at Twente, the last couple of seasons, I mean, he's been pretty much the main striker for those teams. Now with Giovanni Dos Santos out of the picture, I would pretty much expect Tecatito Corona to vie with Javier Hernandez or maybe even Raul Jimenez up front in that starting lineup. So he will give Mexico that dose of speed, that dose of talent that you would normally have with Giovanni Dos Santos. I don't know how much Klinsmann is prepared for Tecatito Corona. I think that is a pretty big storyline going into this game. I think that he can be the key for victory if you're Tuca Ferretti and if you're Mexico. He's that not-so-secret weapon that they're going to deploy, given the fact that Giovanni was the secret weapon that everybody knew about. So it's an interesting thing to look at with just, you know, three games before the match. And it's exciting to think about what the different options that these two coaches are going to present before the game.
Yeah, we're bound to see some sort of surprises, even if it's not necessarily in Ferretti's formational decision, but we do expect, I mean, I don't know what to expect out of Jurgen Klinsmann. That's pretty much par for the course. I do, you know, with Tecatito, with his speed, his 1v1 ability, and the Americans don't have a whole lot of speed defensively. If you play Fabian Johnson at a fullback position, you sort of lose something in the midfield, but maybe you're more solid back there. And do you want to react to the Mexicans, or does Klinsmann intend to, I mean, I don't know why would we expect this at all, but intend to be on the front foot with them at least to start the game? We don't know what the crowd composition will be, although, you know, should be interesting to see. This is not a team that's unfamiliar with the lay of the land at the Rose Bowl necessarily, but as you said, a limited amount of time to acquaint themselves on the day. How much does the transition, the drama surrounding Piojo and going into having Tuca Ferretti step in as an interim manager, and now with the word that Juan Carlos Osorio is likely to take the job permanently, how much of that affects the team, if at all?
There's definitely an effect on the team. I don't know how to gauge it exactly, and I've seen them this week react to questions about Osorio, to questions about this being Tuca Ferretti's only meaningful game, and I haven't really seen a big effect. There's definitely a transition period to be noted, and a grace period. Usually when you have a new manager coming in, even under these circumstances. And I think that the CONCACAF Cup has really killed that grace period for Mexico. now they've got a month before they go into the first round of World Cup qualifying for them. And that's not going to be nearly enough time to get ready for even El Salvador and Honduras. And I don't say that disrespecting El Salvador and Honduras. I say that knowing full well that Mexico is going to be the favorite for those games, regardless of who's coaching. Now, Juan Carlos Osorio has mainly kept his drama to the nation of Brazil over the last week or so with his will he, won't he with Sao Paulo. Now it's pretty much clear cut that he's coming to Mexico. And the players will have to adapt to that. It doesn't matter who's on the sideline, really, for them. They have to go out there and they have to perform. Tactically speaking, it's very different to play under Tuca Ferretti than it is with Juan Carlos Osorio. And I fully expect Juan Carlos Osorio to be in the mold of that coach, that type of coach that Mexico likes, that type of offensive strategy that Mexico favors. You want possession of the ball. You want to bring the game to the opposition. And you want to make sure that you have plenty of shots on goal. That is, in a nutshell, what Juan Carlos Osorio brings. He's a coach in that Bielsa mold and that Jorge Sampaoli mold. And I think it's no coincidence that Mexico looked for Bielsa, looked for Sampaoli before they settled on Juan Carlos Osorio. They are roughly the same type of coach. With Ricardo Ferretti, and this is important as we go into October 10th, you mentioned Klinsmann not necessarily being the guy who's going to bring the game to Mexico. And I think that has been that has been normal when it comes to USA versus Mexico over the course of the last 20 years and that big shift in paradigm that we've had with Mexico completely dominating the series and the United States just being a nuisance for Mexico and really turning this into one of world football's great, great clásicos. Tuca Ferretti is a defensive coach. You know, we're not mincing words here. So this game potentially is going to be very boring if both coaches come out and play the way that they're expected to play.
Yeah.
This game could very well come down to a set piece. It could very well come down to a controversial call by a ref. It could come down to individual talent. That's why I mentioned Tecatito Corona a few minutes ago. It's a very, very different Mexico team that they're going to face on October 10th, the United States.
Well, okay. So that being said, and the stage being set there, I mean, obviously, I'm rolling through, you know, possibilities for the U.S. and what Klinsmann might do, whether or not he'll push his fullbacks, give his fullbacks freedom to roam up the field, and where Michael Bradley ultimately plays. The higher up the field, the more chance there is for Mexico to exploit space in the midfield. But you also need Bradley to be a part of the American attack if they're going to be effective. But so with that being said, and we've talked a lot about the Mexican attack, Eric, is defensively, are there questions for Mexico, or do you feel like things are pretty solid back there right now?
And there are absolutely questions surrounding Mexico's defense, and there have been for the last 2 years or so. I think at this point in time, though, you have Hector Moreno, who is getting regular football at PSV. He's playing for a Champions League caliber team, and he's doing a good job, regardless of the two players that he's injured over the course of the last month. He's regained his confidence, and he's upped his level since arriving at PSV. And then you've got Diego Reyes. Diego Reyes is a guy who had been sitting on the bench for Porto for the last 18 months. Now, he's got regular minutes at Real Sociedad. Again, Real Sociedad isn't necessarily the world-beating team that you would want a player of Reyes' caliber to be playing on, but at least he's getting regular minutes. So now, even with Rafa Marquez potentially out, you've got two center backs who are getting regular minutes in two of the world's top leagues. As for the fullbacks, when you were playing under Miguel Herrera, you expected the fullbacks to be attacking. Certainly a guy like Miguel Layún, certainly another guy like Paul Aguilar have offensive capabilities that you want to exploit, but they're also pretty good markers. And with Tuca Ferretti, they've shown that side a little bit more consistently. So you've got four players who, in the back, are going to pretty much dedicate themselves to defend, and they do a good job of it. I think if we would have looked at this game 3-4 months ago, then I would have been very worried at the state of the Mexican defense, especially in the middle, given that Rafa Márquez would have been your first choice along with Moreno to start in the middle. And, you know, Rafa Márquez is a legend. He's one of the best players ever in CONCACAF, but he's 36 years old, and those legs are not 36 years old. They're even older. So I think it might actually be somewhat of a boon for the United States if he does end up starting. At this point, it's 50-50. He might just be there for the mind games. He might just be there for the leadership aspect and the calming presence of having Rafa Márquez mentor your younger players. But that is one of the big question marks as we move forward. Duque Ferretti is a guy who will train with a starting lineup about 48 hours before the game. So I think on Thursday we'll know if Rafa will be starting or not.
Okay, so and so we'll get as per the Piojo regime some advance notice on who Mexico will start while Jurgen Klinsmann waits until the last minute to let anybody know what's happening.
Right, and Piojo did it 24 hours before. I think, you know, Tuca's not going to come out in a press conference and say this is my starting lineup, but you will see it. You will see it on the pitch. He likes to train with his team with a little bit of anticipation, and he usually doesn't make any last-minute changes, barring injury. So you'll know. I mean, I don't think I'm tipping Jurgen Klinsmann off. I think Jurgen Klinsmann is a guy who does his homework and who knows a lot more about Duque Ferretti than he wants to let on. But that's pretty much the MO with him. You'll know on Thursday whether Rafa Márquez will start or not. So I'm tipping some of my colleagues who are already scouting the United States, if they find out that Rafa is in that first team scrimmage, then you've got 36-year-old Rafa Márquez starting against the United States.
So we'll see what happens there, Eric. Just in general, in the state of this rivalry, I mean, as you said, it's one of the great. I certainly believe this, and I'm as biased as you are. One of the great international classicos right. available, but I don't know. I feel as though things have cooled a little bit, and this tends to happen over time. You know, respect between the two countries seems to be at a high, all time high, both in terms of clubs, but also internationally. I mean, Michael Bradley comes out and puts something on his Instagram and talks about the hate, but I don't know that I feel it's there like it used to be.
Yeah, it's a little bit more manufactured, you can tell, and I think part of that has to do with the fact that at no point in time before this game and the circumstances that we lead up into that game with, at no point in time has there been so much respect for the U.S. team from Mexican media and Mexican fans. And I think that has obviously carried over to Mexican players. Recently, you know, ESPN, of course, Tom Marshall, Jeff Carlisle, two very good friends of mine, published that great oral history of the United States-Mexico rivalry. And we've seen a lot of interviews as the weeks have gone by, as we've gotten closer to this game, with players both present and past, about what this rivalry means to them. And I think the most important thing to take away from those interviews, at least from me, is that players, even in the last decade, in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, have admitted to going into these games against the United States on the Mexican side thinking, this is an easy 3 points. This is a victory for me. There's no reason for me to be upset or worried about what the U.S. can bring to the table. That mentality has shifted greatly in the last 10 years. And now you talk to players like Chicharito, you talk to players like Carlos Vela, you talk to players like Tecatito Corona, guys who have spent most of their adult lives in Europe, who have played for some of the world's best teams. And even then, they will look at the United States team, and I say even then compared to the guys 10 years ago who were playing at America and Chivas and Toluca. They will look at the United States and say, this is a worthy rival, this is a great opponent, and this is a team that we will have a very difficult time beating. So when that happens, you tend to cool off a little bit with the things that you say. I think there's no real underdog here. There's no real favorite here. I think some of us would be contrived by saying, well, you know, Mexico's the favorite. Well, you know, they may have a little bit more gravitas when it comes to the individual talent, but they've got an interim coach.
Yeah.
And they're in a period of serious turmoil. They did not look good during the Gold Cup. You know, Klinsmann and the United States got eliminated in the semifinals. Mexico should have done the same. They should have been eliminated in the semifinals. Yeah. So there's really just a weird ambiance going into this game, I think. Everybody's kind of on their toes, thinking that this game could be as even as any game that we've ever seen between the United States and Mexico. And you've heard things going on in the U.S. camp, you know, people saying that it would have been better to play this game at Azteca. And hell, why wouldn't you play this at Azteca if you're the United States? You feel that you have just as good a chance at winning anywhere at this point. And I think that is one of the virtues that Jurgen Klinsmann has instilled in the U.S. team. And I know that there's a lot of mixed opinion about Klinsmann. And, you know, oh, by the way, U.S. soccer fans, welcome to the rest of the world and how they evaluate their national team coach. Nobody's going to be Bruce Arena for you guys ever again. but it's just a testament to say that you would rather play this game in Azteca. That shows the confidence that the United States has going into this game.
What do you make of Landon Donovan coming out? And obviously, it's easy to just chalk this up to sour grapes after he got left off the 2014 World Cup team. But when he says, you know, in the rest of the world, if Jurgen Klinsmann lost this game, he'd be fired. I think there's truth to that. I do think Klinsmann is judged on a different standard than most head coaches. Does that generate any buzz at all within Mexican circles to kind of see a little bit of American infighting where maybe there wasn't that stuff before?
No, it was a huge deal. It was a huge deal. It was everywhere. I think Landon Donovan is a guy that holds the most amount of individual respect when it comes to what U.S. soccer has produced over the last 100 years. So whenever Landon Donovan says anything about U.S. soccer, says anything about the rivalry against Mexico, people are listening and people are engaged with him. Yeah, he's held to different standards, and I think that's a good thing, actually. I know that now with so many U.S. soccer fans adopting other leagues, you've seen how people operate with their managers and how itchy a trigger finger some owners have with their managers. But the real issue and the thing that you've got to realize here is that Jurgen Klinsmann was a target for Sunil Gulati and for U.S. soccer for so many years, and I know that everybody knows that, but one of the big selling points that Klinsmann has is that he's part of that German project that has given that national team Yogi Löw and has given them a World Cup title in the last year. So I think the expectation for Klinsmann is more long-term than it is short-term. Now, let's really think about this in terms of rest of world versus USA. Yeah, I think if you had Miguel Herrera sitting as Mexico manager right now, and Mexico is coming off a terrible Gold Cup, you've got infighting, you've got players acting like children, you've got media versus players, fans versus players, just a really negative ambiance around that team, and you go into October 10th against your biggest rival, and you've got all this stuff hanging over your head, you lose that game, you're Mexico, Miguel Herrera's probably out the door. Mm-hmm. And I think when you apply that standard to Klinsmann and you apply what Landon Donovan said in terms of the United States not having a good summer, then it would certainly make sense to kick Klinsmann out if he doesn't win that game. But let's really put this into perspective. Aside from this being a Clásico, aside from this being the biggest rivalry in CONCACAF, what is there really to gain? A Confederations Cup, spot in Russia 2017. What does the Confederations Cup give to you as a footballing nation, as a soccer nation? Very little. Yeah. It gives, you know, Fox an opportunity to broadcast 3-4 games in the summer of 2017 and make a lot of revenue, which is the same in Mexico if you're Televisa and TV Azteca. But other than that, you maybe play Chile, right, which is a great team, but is not Brazil or Argentina.
Right.
You maybe play the winner of the 2016 Euro, which again could be anybody at this point, but you know, let's say it's Germany, or let's say it's Spain, or let's say it's, you know, even a team like Italy or France. Mm-hmm. Those are really good teams, but it's nothing more than one or potentially two matches against very, very good teams, because you've also got the OFC title holder, and you've got the AFC title holder, and the African title holder as well. So it's not the World Cup, and it's not a showcase against the best. It's not a tournament that is going to create a lot of pride if you win it going forward. It's a great moment. Mexico certainly has their great moment in 1999 when they beat a U23 Brazil with Ronaldinho, and they won the Confederations Cup at home. But aside from that, it's not necessarily the trophy that is going to allow you to set yourself apart from the rest of the region and say, hey, we're the United States. Hey, we're Mexico. We just won Confederations Cup. Who wants next? You know what I mean? So I think that Landon Donovan is speaking definitely from his experience as a player. And he's also got a little bit of that resentment that is definitely there from last year. Part of what he says makes sense. The other part, I think, is just him just trying to create a little bit more pressure for Klinsmann, given what those two have been through over the last 18 months.
Yep. All right, we could do this all day. Eric Gomez fighting through injury here. He's playing hurt, and he's joined us on Soccer Morning, and he's doing an excellent job as always. Eric, I appreciate the time. Looking forward to just Saturday. Have a safe trip to L.A., and I'm sure we'll talk to you soon.
I just hope that when I listen to this later today, I didn't have one of those episodes with too much cold medicine that makes me say a really stupid thing.
No, everything was brilliant. Thanks for the time, Eric. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll shift over two topics in Europe. Jurgen Klopp moving from Germany to Liverpool with Ross Dunbar. Don't go anywhere. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com. When it comes to the USA against Mexico, this game's different. As Michael Bradley puts it, the passion, the colors, the respect, the hate. Soccer Morning listeners, I'd like to invite you to join me and Jared Dubois this Saturday for the USA versus Mexico broadcast on Rabble.tv at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. With Rabble, the concept is simple. All you have to do is tune into the USA versus Mexico game on TV, press the mute button, and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me and Jared on your desktop, through your iOS Android app, or through your mobile browser. Plus, before or during the game, you can join in by posting your questions or observations in the comments section. Or why don't you create your own broadcast, call one of your team's games. It's easy. Sign up for free today. Try it out. Join me and Jared this Saturday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern for the USA versus Mexico on Rabble.tv, where it's your team and your call.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
We are back on Soccer Morning on a Wednesday, and now we turn to topics in Europe, specifically topics on Merseyside, but we're going to do it through a German lens with our friend Ross Dunbar, who covers German football. He happens to be stateside at the moment, which is excellent for the timing of this discussion. It means we're not interrupting anything late afternoon. Ross, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, and I have to say that the hospitality this side of the pond is excellent so far. So
there you go. I'm glad our friends in Chicago are treating you right. If you are listening from Chicago and you happen to see Ross on the street, make sure you wave and say I heard you on Soccer Morning. Okay, Ross, the story dominating headlines on the club side of the game these days is certainly the likelihood of Jurgen Klopp taking over at Liverpool after Brendan Rodgers was summarily dismissed on Sunday after the Merseyside derby. Many questions here, but let's start with why Liverpool for Jurgen Klopp.
I think it was inevitable from the beginning, because Jurgen Klopp, like a lot of Germans of his generation, grew up when Liverpool were very successful. So the perception of Liverpool in Europe is still very, very strong. Of course, we know that they're not challenging for the Premier League right now, but they might be able to do that with someone of Klopp's calibre. And yeah, I mean, I think he's always said that the one country that he wanted to coach in outside of Germany was England because he spoke the language. And as far as I understand, he's been taking extra language courses to improve that. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether it's it's going to be like Klopp's first few years in Dortmund, or it'll be like his last few, which unfortunately were not so good.
Now, he seems like a man who is very well suited to the environment of England. He's certainly the media environment that he's going to face there. Liverpool being one of the historically great clubs of England doesn't seem beyond him. And I think that there's a very small group of managers who are in that realm. Now, you have to have the experience. And I guess what we're saying here is that Jurgen Klopp has built up enough credit and has enough gravitas to handle this, Ross.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think he'll be moved by any of the pressures. I mean, what would probably concern me, I think, is obviously having watched Dortmund under Klopp for a few years, is that I think he can be quite stubborn at times tactically, and I don't know whether that's something that would be useful for Liverpool, especially if they go back into the Champions League. I mean, that was Brendan Rodgers' own failing, was that he changed tactics so many times and he was trying to do so many different things at the one time, whereas Klopp, I think, will have his ideas. He'll try and work on that in training. I think the players that he has at Liverpool probably will suit that. And it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. I mean, I'm not sure he's going to be a long-term appointment because, you know, most managers tend to burn out after 2 or 3 years. But, I mean, if you can get Liverpool back on the right track within that period of time, then I think it would be, without doubt, a massive success.
Now, He's a big name and he has a reputation. I think it's been very astutely pointed out on this show and in other places that by sitting on the sidelines, by taking a sabbatical, his stock has only risen, Ross. I think that's a incredible. I think we're going to, for a manager like Klopp, we saw it with Guardiola, when you come off of success, and I know he didn't finish out well at Dortmund, but he'd taken them to heights. He had challenged Bayern Munich. He had done things that certainly made him a notable name and a very hot commodity. When you take that step aside and you don't lose, because that's what it is, he didn't have a chance to lose games, your stock only rises. Is he maximizing his value at this point? Is that part of this?
I would imagine so. I'm sure he's had his offers. I mean, I've saw that he was linked with the Mexico national team job. I think he turned that down apparently. So I mean, he probably has had several offers from teams that wanted to have his services. I mean, it's obviously interesting as well that he was linked with the Bayern Munich job with Pep Guardiola. So I mean, that's another interesting strand to this whole situation. I think it was really important for him to take a bit of time out because Dortmund in the last 2 years, their decline was pretty remarkable. And while there were injuries and there were other sort of factors in that, I think Klopp's management and some things maybe were part of that problem. I'm not trying to say that he's going to do that at Liverpool, but I think it was important for him probably to go out of the game and probably analyse what went wrong in the last 2 years, and that'll probably be a benefit to Klopp, I think, going into Liverpool, where he can understand his weaknesses and he can improve on them, and hopefully the same thing doesn't really happen again if he stays for 3 or 4 years at Anfield.
Part of the modern game is not just how much you spend, Ross, and certainly a club like Liverpool has resources, maybe not on the level of a Bayern Munich or a PSG or some of the new rich Manchester City, for example, but they have resources, and so much of the modern game is recruitment. And I think a lot of what people are looking at here is not only does Klopp have the tactical ability to succeed in the Premier League, but he is also a recruiter. He has the ability to recruit players in a way maybe Brendan Rodgers couldn't.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think what was interesting about Klopp's time at Dortmund was that when he didn't have a lot of money to spend, his recruitment was very, very good. But when he did have a lot of money to spend, his recruitment was a little bit questionable at times. I mean, they spent $25 million on Ciro Immobile. I think they spent about $10 million on Adrian Ramos. Henrik Mkhitaryan cost about $25 million. And obviously, during Klopp's first couple of seasons, he didn't really hit the ground running. So I think when he's presented with that kind of money, obviously it's unfair to kind of say that he's not going to be able to use it at Liverpool. But I think it's certainly with the transfer committee, that will probably will help him. I think having that kind of assistance, I'm not sure that You know, all of the blame for Rodgers' sacking could be put on the transfer committee. I think that's how most clubs work nowadays, that you have several individuals who are involved in this decision-making. I mean, it'll be interesting, again, to see, you know, whether he goes back to Dortmund and tries to get some of the players that he worked with for 4 or 5 years. I think a few of those players, like Nevin Subotic, for example, haven't really been able to get into Thomas Tuchel's side. I mean, he's a good defender, and I think players like that would certainly enhance the Liverpool squad trying to get back into the Champions League.
That's a radioactive name around these parts. I'm just kidding. I'm over it, but a lot of people are not. So he steps into a Liverpool job. We talk a lot about poison chalice jobs, Ross. Obviously, this isn't necessarily one of those, depending on how things go. But he does. There is some danger here, certainly. I mean, there is going to be immense pressure. He seems to already have this glow about him, and the Liverpool fans are already anointing him a savior. And I think that can be dangerous when maybe the expectations don't necessarily rise to the level of win the title, succeed in the Champions League, but they're going to expect something fairly quickly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was one of the things that I found quite surprising about the Rodgers decision was that, you know, Liverpool, let's be honest about it, even with their great history, they're not one of the top three or four teams in England based on ability. I mean, they've still got a long way to go to bridge that gap. Okay, you know, Chelsea and other teams have had pretty abysmal seasons, but I think if you look at it over 4 or 5 years, Liverpool are going to have to make a pretty massive improvement to get into the Champions League. And obviously, you know, if England loses its fourth place, then you're having to, you're having to get into the top three, which again, you know, these are massive expectations on someone like Klopp. But I think he'll be able to handle it. I mean, you know, at Dortmund, while, you know, he had the kind of freedom to be the kind of face of that club, I mean, you know, playing in front, coaching a team that plays in front of 80,000 every week is quite a big demand. And certainly in that region of Germany, the importance of identity is massive to a club like Dortmund. So I think you'll understand it. And I think that's why it was such an easy match to make, because Liverpool have that kind of following. They'll have that atmosphere at the Kop again. I think you'll probably see a surge in interest in the club. And I think we have to be realistic. You know, I think it's not going to happen overnight. It might happen overnight. You never know. He might be that kind of saviour. But I think, you have to give him some time and allow him to, you know, make those ideas happen, because even at Dortmund, it took him time as well to create the team that went on to win the championship. I think it was 2 years of kind of mid-table finishes, doing a little bit in Europe here and there. So I think there needs to be an element of patience so long as that you can see some progress.
You know, there are a lot of reasons why this is a good fit, and there are only so many elite jobs in the world. The big paying jobs, the clubs that are expected to challenge for Champions League titles every year. He's been linked to some of those, and you mentioned Bayern Munich. And is there a sense within Germany that the decision to go to Liverpool, not only because he has the attraction to the football culture of England, but also maybe because he didn't want to wait out Pep Guardiola?
I think it was probably more to do with the identity thing. I think having done so well at Dortmund, you know, having even had the poor seasons of the last 2 years and still walked out as a saviour, you know, I think he wouldn't have wanted to maybe frustrate Dortmund fans going to Bayern Munich at the end of the season. I mean, obviously, I think based on what I've read over the last couple of weeks, I think the likelihood of Pep Guardiola staying at Bayern Munich is actually increasing. You know, the contract talks will happen in the next few weeks, and maybe that was something that Klopp has seen and decided not to wait it out, because if Guardiola decides to stay, then you know he's left out of a job for the rest of the season. But I think it was always Klopp's intention to go to England. I mean, he said that in several interviews, and as we said, I mean, I think Liverpool is probably as close as it gets to someone like Dortmund when he took over in 2008, I think. So, you know, I think it'll be a massive, massive interest in Germany to see how he performs, which again will be good for Liverpool, for the reputation, and good for the Premier League as well.
We shall see how it goes for Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. Very interesting opportunity for him and for Liverpool to grab one of the top managers in the world. Let's be honest. Does this mean he'll succeed? Not necessarily, but every reason to believe he'll find some joy there on Merseyside. Let me turn now to some club items here, or at least one club item within Germany, Ross, before I have to let you go, and that's in relation to the league. you said it before we came on the air. The league is over. It is October 7th. We have barely dipped our toes into this season's waters, and yet the conventional wisdom is that Bayern Munich is already it can already etch their name on the trophy. We've got Dortmund's CEO Hans-Joachim Watzke saying as much in the press. I don't know that he's complaining as much as he's just identifying the situation. Is this? I mean, it's bad, right? It can't be good.
I think it depends what you look for in a league. I mean, I think for a few years the Premier League was a bit of a one horse race for a lot of the time, with Chelsea doing so well and Man City. I think you have to kind of give Bayern some credit a little bit. I mean, I know that it doesn't look good for the league, but I was there at the Allianz Arena on Sunday and I was genuinely taken aback by how good they were. It kind of changed my perspective on whether Bayern are serious Champions League contenders. I think the way that they've dispatched teams in the Bundesliga this year, Leverkusen for example, is really impressive. You know, you look at the improvement in someone like Lewandowski. I mean, this guy is genuinely incredible to watch right now. I mean, he looks stronger, quicker, you know, more confident than in recent seasons. And I suppose it is bad for the league if you look for competition. I mean, it's kind of one of those situations where, you know, there's not really a solution. You know, I mean, I think it probably reflects European football in general right now. You have four or five clubs who are, you know, your super clubs on the continent: Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Juventus, probably. And these clubs will probably monopolize their divisions. But I don't know what the solution is. I mean, do they bring in salary caps? Do they try to change the format of the league? Or do they just accept that maybe this Bayern team has, you know, broken down so many barriers and become, you know, quite an exceptional team? And maybe in the next few years, if Guardiola was to leave, maybe that would change. But obviously, it's important as well, because this is the first time in Bundesliga history that a team would go on and win the league 4 years in a row. So, I mean, this is kind of unprecedented dominance for Bayern Munich in Germany.
Yeah, you know, I guess it is a little bit of a seesaw between, you know, greatness and obviously, as you said, sort of the 1% of Europe is being consolidated consistently year over year. It's not that long ago that somebody else won the league, but at the same time, there seems to be at least some movement, and I'm not saying that it's a predominance. I'm not saying we're going to reach a tipping point anytime soon, Ross, but there seems to be some movement within Germany and a couple other places around Europe for leveling the playing field a little bit, at least. And I think Oliver Bierhoff had some recent comments, which fall in line with some other things I've heard, where, you know, just a general sort of moaning about this and saying we might want to consider salary restrictions or you know, I know it's anathema for a lot of people, but salary caps in order to make the leagues more competitive. Now, I think that actually ends up pushing the big clubs, the massive clubs, out into a European super league eventually, but that might not happen anytime soon. Is there whether or not it happens, is there real actual talk, or is this just the musings of some bitter people?
I think you hear salary caps being brought up every so often online and in the media and whatever. And I mean, I'm not sure if it's the definite solution, but it wouldn't surprise me that Germany would try to do something like that, because, you know, German football already has its licensing restrictions anyway. So clubs have to financially meet certain criteria, and they have to submit financials to the league and all that kind of thing. So there is already that kind of financial regulation happening in Germany. It's just whether there would be a movement to have such a restriction on salaries and whatnot. And the thing that I think the really kind of worrying thing for German football fans about Bayern Munich is that they're not bankrolled by some, you know, some foreign owner like in England. You know, this is a club that's been incredibly well managed over the last 20 years. And Uli Hoeneß once said that he wanted somebody to talk about Bayern Munich every single day publicly. You know, he wanted Bayern Munich to be the big thing in Germany, and clearly they are. Yeah. For me, I think the other teams have to improve. You know, I think you look at a team like Wolfsburg, for example, who really should have been title contenders this year, but their handling of the De Bruyne situation for me was really poor. They allowed it to drag on early on in the season. They dropped a couple of points. They let it drag out until the end of the window, and then their replacement was Julian Draxler, which seemed to me quite a lazy signing. And he's clearly not anywhere near as good as De Bruyne either. Dortmund over the last few years have spent badly. So I mean, I think a lot of the teams have to get better, and that's the reality. I mean, I don't think the German Football League, the DFL, would want to hold Bayern back because they want to be successful in the Champions League, which is obviously the number one priority, and they want to market the league internationally. So you have to have that element of star quality. You know, if they want to broadcast in the United States, for example, or in China, they want to have a team that is in the last few rounds of the Champions League. And this was the problem. 10 years ago, they weren't getting to this stage. The league was competitive, but they weren't good enough to get to the last four of the Champions League. So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation. Do you increase the competition by bringing the quality down, or do you do it vice versa? I don't think it's an easy situation.
No, certainly not. They can't. They're unlikely to do anything within Germany that's going to impact, as you said, their Champions League fortunes, which means it would have to be in concert with pretty much everybody else in Europe. And as we know, getting everyone in Europe on the same page is literally impossible. So I don't know what this, if there is a solution, I don't know what it is, and maybe it's not enough of a problem to merit one. Quickly here, you mentioned Wolfsburg. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you for your perspective on what the Volkswagen controversy here in the United States with the EPA violations, what kind, and obviously the shakeup at Volkswagen itself. Well, what kind of impact that will have on Wolfsburg, which, while, as you said, the licensing restrictions and the ownership restrictions of Germany notwithstanding, is ultimately a company team in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So to kind of explain, I mean, Wolfsburg was a city that was created for Volkswagen, the car manufacturer, and Wolfsburg is basically a workers team. So I mean, if you have a workers team for your company in the US, it's exactly the same thing. Apart from in the 1990s, Volkswagen decided, okay, let's put some money into the team, and they brought in a sporting director, and their success was pretty rapid. They got to the German Cup final, I think, in about 1994. That was the first kind of major success for them, and then obviously they've gone on to win the championship in 2009, got into the Champions League, and now they are undoubtedly one of the strongest teams in Germany in terms of the players they have. I mean, one of the guys on the Volkswagen board, I mean, his name completely passes me by, but he said that they would leave no stone unturned when it comes to trying to obviously solve this problem, and obviously that would mean that any marketing activities. I mean, you've got to remember as well that Volkswagen sponsors something like 12 out of the 18 Bundesliga clubs. It sponsors 5 or 6 second division clubs, and they are pretty big sponsors for the DFB, for the German Cup, for example. So, I mean, their stranglehold over German football is pretty significant. And I mean, the thing is, I mean, with Volkswagen, I mean, a team like Wolfsburg is probably 0.005% of their overall marketing budget, but whether this emission scandal forces them to kind of close down projects like that, I mean, I can't see it, to be honest, but you never know. I mean, it depends the severity of the situation, and I think a lot of people probably don't really know what that's going to be like at the moment.
Ross Dunbar 93 is his Twitter handle. You should go follow him. He covers German football for Fox Sports and some other places, and he's in Chicago enjoying the American hospitality. I wish you a good trip, Ross, both in Chicago and then when you make your way back to Europe. Thank you very much for the time. Great stuff.
Cheers. Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
There goes Ross. Good stuff from him. We're going to take a break. We'll open the phone lines, and we'll talk to you. What's on your mind on a Wednesday? Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
We're back on Soccer Morning, and the phone lines are open, 646-832-3909. So go ahead and jump on in. Let me know what you want to talk about ahead of USA-Mexico on Saturday. Couple of MLS games tonight. Everything happening with Mexico. Jurgen Klopp taking over at Liverpool. That seems to be coming. We don't have we talked about it with Ross like it was official. It's not officially official, at least that I know of. But all signs point to Klopp. It's going to be an interesting time for Liverpool moving into the Klopp era. But let's focus on what's happening in Pasadena on Saturday night with our friend Ray in Milwaukee. What's up, Ray?
Hey, Jay. I think this game and this format is totally needs to change. And it needs to change to become fairer for all of CONCACAF because it's a regional tournament. And if they can do it in Africa and they can do it in Asia, they can do it here.
You mean move it around? You
but
mean,
I got a call out.
You mean move the tournament around?
I got a call out a red.
Okay, go ahead.
I got a call out a redhead, a big head, and a bald head. Oh. Because they've been very vocal on a lot of other issues about corruption in this sport. And yet, if the shoe was on the other foot, and all three of these games were played outside of the United States, they'd be much more vocal about the format change.
Okay, when you say format change, do you mean where these games are happening? What are you talking about necessarily? What three games, Ray?
The two Gold Cup finals. The first one that he even played, whoever wins to get the gold to the Confederation Cup automatically has to take a weaker team because you're taking your strongest team to this Confederation Cup, which is ridiculous, you know. So, where the games are played as well. The fact is that this is always going to be played here in the United States, and it favors two teams, really, Mexico and the United States. But the problem I have, too, is when people go out here and say that, this is a home field advantage for the Mexicans because there's so many Mexican fans, I think you're really downplaying the home field advantage that Estadio Azteca presents. And that if you look at most finals are played on a Sunday afternoon, which, like, Mexico hasn't lost a day game in Azteca, like, never. The games that they have lost have been night games. If you're going to play this playoff game, why don't you play a home and away series like you do every other tournament to determine to get into the tournament?
Ray, you've got good points. I got a ton of people waiting online, so I'm going to let you go. But you got good points. The format of the Gold Cup, the format of the Confederations Cup playoff situation that's been created for this, the fact that, as Ray says, I mean, there are a lot of things not to like here. I think he was talking about Twelman, Lawless, and Friedel, right? But look, I think everybody is aware that the Gold Cup format is not the best thing. It's just not. Daniel, Atlanta, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, Jason?
Doing well, my friend.
I just wanted to chime in about the national team that I'm hoping that they win and that the U.S. national team boys, man, the U-23s, man, they're doing well.
Yeah, they are. They're doing well. They have to win one more game to get qualified, but they look pretty good. They obviously needed Kiesa Vetter and Morris to come on that game last night. I actually watched a little bit of that. Andres Cantor on the call. Fantastic. They needed that addition of attacking prowess to get over Panama. They didn't look good in the first half. They had trouble with connecting some passes in the final third. But there's talent enough there, and they're doing this in a very professional manner, which is definitely a contrast to 2012. It's a breath of fresh air.
Exactly. And when it comes to Liverpool, I blame Fenway. I will always blame Fenway for how they're doing the whole Liverpool situation.
Okay, but they're definitely better than Hicks and Gillette. We can agree on that, right? Right? Yeah.
I guess. I mean,
you guess. All right.
I still wouldn't like an American group owning something that isn't American. You get what I'm saying?
I guess. Daniel, I'm all ready to give you a... By the way, you've been a regular caller for a long time. I don't know if we've heard from you in a while. But I was all ready to give you a shirt number. Do you want one?
Sure.
What do you want? What number?
I want 68.
That's an incredibly weird number, but I'm going to give it to you. Appreciate the call, Daniel. Good stuff.
No problem. See you later.
There goes Daniel in Atlanta. All right, we got a bunch of calls here. We'll stick around until we can get through most of you guys. We're going to have to cut it off at some point. Richard in Philly. What's up?
Hey, Jason, what's up?
Going well. Number 21, Richard in Philly. What's going on?
Yeah. One of my problems is I like the idea of the CONCACAF Cup, but I think I can't get behind the meaning of it, mainly because it seemed like the more it came out, the more it seemed like this was just nothing more than another CONCACAF cash grab that they decided to do, like, along with the Copa America. And like, we had the Gold Cup for 20 years, Confederations Cup for 20 years. Now they decided to have a playoff game.
Oh yeah, it's completely contrived to make cash. I think everybody's aware of that. That doesn't necessarily eliminate the possibility that it has meaning, but I think it definitely takes away from it. And as Ray in Milwaukee was saying, it doesn't seem right. He said, "Oh, why not play home and away two-legged series?" The reason you don't do that is because you don't have the big set piece moment. Maybe you get to sell out two games, but you don't have that big set piece moment. It doesn't drive up the television rights as much. I think, you know, clearly they want to maximize the fact that there's an American fan base and a Mexican fan base that they can leverage in one place. I mean, yeah, I'm with you, Richard. It doesn't feel clean.
Yeah, it's like when we had the same kind of feeling. Like, everybody's like, "Oh, it's the biggest game ever." Like, really? Do you really believe it's the biggest game ever with nothing to see? Nothing more than them in Miami just go, "We need another game just to get make all our pockets bigger." Like, it just doesn't have the same feeling.
I
clean feeling, like you said.
I wonder if it's going to be something that takes on. I appreciate the call, Richard. I got to run. I wonder if it's going to take on the feeling of a big game over time. But the problem is, this is the first one. It's very hard to create any sort of real big feeling because there's no legacy to it. And you're not guaranteed to get another one. And when you do get another one, it won't be for 4 years. It's so strange. Scott in New York, you're on the air.
Hey, Jason. First quick comment. Jonathan was amazing. Thanks so much for entertaining us the last few days.
Good. Thank you. Good to hear that. Jonathan did a great job. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess just kind of playing off what you were just saying a little bit, my question is kind of about the greater meaning that this game might have in developing soccer nationally a little more. I mean, it's 9:30 on a Eastern on a Saturday, I'm guessing. But, you know, a lot of the big games will be over for college football. And I'm just wondering if this fits in anywhere into the narrative of, you know, making soccer bigger domestically, or is this just kind of a game for the people who are already into it?
I don't know. It's in such a weird spot. I mean, I think there still will be college football on. In fact, I don't know what the ESPN ABC primetime game is on Saturday night, but there's always a game in that window. That's pretty big. So let me look at the schedule real quick here for a second to see. You've got, okay, nothing big. I guess I'm not seeing a whole lot that's big at that point in the evening. I'm sure Jonathan Tannenwald's got a handle on what big games are coming up on Saturday night that will compete with USA. Florida, Missouri at 7:30. That will trickle over. I don't know where that game is being broadcast. TCU is number two in the country. They've got Kansas State at 7:30. Michigan State plays Rutgers at 8. Miami plays Florida State at 8.
Yeah.
So those games are still big
games. A lot of regional games.
Yeah, no, they all have a regional feel about them, but they're going at least one. California, Utah is at 10 o'clock on Saturday night. That's 20.
Yeah, I'm watching that and USA Mexico personally.
You're splitting your. I don't think this game is going to have sort of a knock on effect for improving the profile. I just don't think it's going to have that effect. I mean, I think it'll get a big number clearly on Spanish language television. I think Fox will do relatively well with it, all things considered. But I don't think this is going to be one of those moments where, wow, look at the 10 million people that watch this game on English language television. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and expanding it to, you know, discussion earlier about Klinsmann, where, you know, this isn't really going to necessarily affect his tenure, and who knows what this actually does in terms of, you know, if he's ever, you know, if he's making changes to his rotation based on this game. Like, it's kind of funny because you kind of wonder, like, what's going to be the lasting effect of this game? Is it going to mean anything, or, you know, the kind of a glorified friendly, for lack of a better.
Yeah, I mean, Klinsmann already has his insulation in place. I don't think anything's going to change there. Thanks for the call, Scott. I do think that, you know, look, I saw somebody on Twitter say, you know, this is supposed to be Hate Mexico Week, but we've turned it into Hate Klinsmann Week. And there may be some truth to that. And I know I'm guilty of feeding the narrative that, that Klinsmann should be under more pressure, just as Landon Donovan has. But obviously, Landon Donovan is the one that has goosed this whole thing. And I wonder if we built that narrative up. I'm not saying we should, but I'm saying if the story that Jurgen Klinsmann was coaching for his job, if that was a legitimate thing, if that was in play, I wonder if more people would watch. I wonder if that would drive more people to this game to talk about what happens in this match and watch this match because it might mean a coaching change. Tyler, Virginia, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Jason, what's going on? First, I just want to respond to one thing that I heard while I was waiting to come on the air. That Ray in Milwaukee said. He said he blamed Fenway for, you know, what's going on at Liverpool right now. And just real quick, it needs to be said, Jason, that Brendan Rodgers, you know, he was at Liverpool for 3 years. He had £300 million to spend. So you can't say that Fenway hasn't been supporting him, that Fenway hasn't been supporting this club, that they haven't, you know, run this club in a way that should prevent them from being criticized just for the sake of their nationality.
Okay. But let me say that was Daniel in Atlanta who said that. And while I agree with you to a point, I do think that Fenway has had trouble instituting their policies in an efficient manner. Their message has been muddled within the club. I think that they didn't necessarily have a strong plan for how to support Brendan Rodgers, give him the necessary necessary authority, while at the same time, you know, look, you could dump money into a project that obviously helps, but you got to still at least have some sort of idea how you're going to get where you want to go. And I'm not sure that they did, Tyler. What else is on your mind?
But yeah, I really wanted to call and just talk about the U23s briefly. I heard you say that, that you were kind of pleased that they've been, kind of going about their business in a more professional manner, you know, in comparison to the last Olympic cycle, which I agree with 100%. But one thing, that I'm still kind of wondering about, and we won't know until, you know, they play like a Mexico or something like that, but how is this team going to stack up against, you know, better competition?
Sure.
Because I mean, like, you know, it's really encouraging to see that they've handled their business and taken care of the teams that they're supposed to beat. Because obviously, like I said, you know, like that didn't happen, back in, 2012. So right now though, I mean, I take all the success with a grain of salt, if you will.
Okay, fair enough.
Because, you know, they still haven't played anybody.
Sure. Fair enough. They've only played the teams in front of them. We can't judge them. We don't know but they're going to get that opportunity. They're probably going to get Honduras in the semifinals. Although it is possible it's possible for Honduras to beat Mexico tonight, and that would end up with a USA Mexico semifinal, which is obviously a huge game. Either way, they're going to play somebody of a better quality than what they've seen so far, and they do get two shots at this. They do get a shot to win the semi and book their place in the Olympics. And if they don't do that, they'll go into the third place match and they'll have a chance to book their place that way.
But we will see. Well, though, that means if they go into the third place match and if they take third, then they have to go into another playoff.
Oh, you mean with another confederation? I haven't checked ahead on that. But you know, we can only, as you said, we can only judge them on what they've done so far, and they've done a professional job. I'm not getting effusive with my praise yet, Tyler, but we should be encouraged.
Definitely. Right. I mean, like you said, the change in attitude and approach, and just the way that it seems like these guys have been prepared, seems like night and day. Okay. So that's a really, really positive sign, because I mean, I don't really know that a lot of people had high hopes for this group, just, you know, with the names on paper.
We did have some questions defensively. We had some questions up top, who was going to score the goals. Well, it turns out Jordan Morris is very good. Jerome Kiesewetter has been the player of the tournament for the U.S. I got to run, Tyler. I'm running out of time. Appreciate the call. I got two more calls I'm going to get to, and then we're going to have to cut it off. Let's go to Carlos down in Florida. What's up, Carlos?
Hey, what's up? I just want to address something that was said earlier on the show. As far as Klinsmann goes, you know, it was asked, what would we gain if we fired Klinsmann? But I think a lot of people are just kind of in a position where they're asking themselves, what are we gaining by keeping him?
Sure.
Because the results aren't there. And it's just, as a fan, I'm just getting tired of every time he loses a game, he kind of talks down to the fans like, well, you guys really don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
So just let me do my job.
Yeah.
But he's not doing his job. That's the whole thing. And I mean, are we going to stick with this guy, you know, qualified to the World Cup? And because it's leading up to what I think is we're going to qualify to the World Cup and it's going to be a disappointment. Because it's at this point, it's an ongoing pattern. So my question is, why are we keeping this guy?
You know, I think the ultimate question for U.S. soccer and whether they pull the trigger is kind of beyond the point here, but the ultimate question is whether or not he is poisoning the well, whether he's doing damage. If he's not doing damage, you've got $2.5 million invested in him in terms of annual salary. You've given him the technical director job, and you're asking him to reform the structure or the culture of American soccer. I do think that that job's too big for one man. I don't know that even within the U.S. program, he's doing great things. I'm not saying he's the issue is it's difficult to see the evidence. So if you're U.S. soccer, you fire him if you believe he's doing damage because you have too much invested in him. That's ultimately their decision. I'm not even advocating for him to be fired if they lose on Saturday necessarily, unless the entire team has turned on him, unless there's some sort of mutiny, unless the result. Thanks for the call, Carlos. I gotta go. Unless the result is so damaging to the future prospects of the team and the confidence of the team that you are risking further failure and regression. And I don't know that, are we there? Is that where we are? I question whether or not he's delivering on his promises, but that's a very different question than saying fire the man. Let's go to Mark Fishkin. Hey, Mark.
How are you? I'll talk very quickly because I know I'm your last caller and you've got very, very lot of things to do. I just want to mention you haven't talked tonight about the two very important MLS matches.
You know,
Red Bull hosting Montreal and Vancouver hosting Dallas.
I mentioned them off the top of the show, Mark. I haven't had a chance to dive into them. I think this is huge for Montreal. The more I look at the schedule, the more I do think it's possible for Orlando to catch them. If they don't get more than 4 points, I mean they got to get at least 4 points just to be sure of a tie in the standings. Meanwhile, you know the Red Bulls. I mean, tell me what your team's playing for, Mark. I mean, there's things on the table here still.
Oh my goodness! No, there's tons to play for. The team is very, very focused on first getting clinching that first round bye. That is absolutely their next hurdle that they have to climb, and they're going to be all about it. New York has never lost to Montreal in a league game at Red Bull Arena. They never lost them at all. They had a CCL draw last year. And so this team is going to be as focused as ever. They were able to handle Kay Kamara really, really well last week. Obviously, they'll be facing Drogba, who sat out their last game on the weekend to rest for this match. It'll be exciting. And then, of course, for the Red Bulls and for anyone watching the Shield race, the Vancouver-Dallas game has a ton of impact as well. Mm-hmm. The late game out in Vancouver. So everyone will in New York, at least the Red fans, will be certainly hoping for a draw there.
All right. If the world does not end today, then we will have MLS soccer to watch with big playoff implications, seeding implications. Mark Fishkin from Seeing Red right here on backhill.com joining us. Mark, good reminder to talk MLS and a good place to finish. Thanks for the call.
Be well, thanks.
There goes Mark Fishkin. Always love talking to Mark. All right, that's going to do it. We've gone into bonus extra time today. That's cool. Thank you very much to Eric Gomez and Ross Dunbar for their contributions to today's program. Reminder, Saturday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, USA-Mexico, from the Rose Bowl. If you're watching on television, there you could not do a better thing than tuning into Rabble.tv to listen to myself and Jared Dubois call that game on Rabble. I'm very much looking forward to that. Should be fun. Set your clocks, your watches, or put a reminder on your phone. Send yourself an email. Write it on a post-it note. Do whatever you need to do. Rabble.tv, 9:30 p.m. Eastern on Saturday night. All right, we got to run. That's it. Thank you very much to producer Trevor for his work today. To all of you who called, all you tweeters, follow us on Twitter, at Soccer Morning. And, I'm out. See you later.
Disappear. What up on my